Good evening, everybody. Welcome to what should be a very interesting and important and informative evening on a problem that's been around for a long time. We entitled the program, the New Opportunities to Solve an Old Problem. And we'll see, apparently there's an article in the Jewish Week just came out of today on a new initiative in Israel. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg involved in a new initiative. I imagine it'll come up on the panel. I think I just heard about it a few hours ago. Before we start, I want to thank the Lakshans, who was on their initiative. We are running the program. It was Marty, actually, when I was talking to him, who recommended we do such a program, and to make me aware of the currency of the issue. Often, if you don't, you know, come face to face with a problem, you think maybe it doesn't exist. And of course, for those who deal with this, there's no greater tragedy than to someone being an aguna. We have a wonderful panel, and we really, I think, it's an all-star group. And without further ado, I'll introduce my partner, Dr. Elliot Malamud, who will introduce the program and moderate the program. The basic schedule will go for approximately an hour and a half, more or less, and then we'll take questions from the floor. Vakasha, thank you very much.
Good evening. The issue of agunot, of women who are stuck in marriages and cannot remarry, has ramifications, obviously, first and foremost for those women. But it's also a problem that's central to any perception of halacha as a fair and just system. As the first Mishnah in Kiddushin tells us, a woman is only freed from her husband through receiving a get, a writ of divorce, or through the death of her husband. And the latter example of igun, that of proving that one's spouse had died, was a very poignant case throughout Jewish history, right up to our day, involving situations like the Shoah, 9/11, and, of course, tragic cases of Israeli soldiers whose whereabouts cannot be accounted for. But clearly the most prominent and numerous case of agunah today, and the ones that are certainly in the forefront of public and media attention, even beyond the Jewish community, have to do with recalcitrant husbands who refuse to grant a get to their wives. The get, according to biblical law, has to be given by the husband to the wife of his own free will, and this need for agreement by the husband can and has led to situations where the withholding of a get may be used as a bargaining chip for money or for custody or merely as an act of spite or revenge. Even if civilly divorced, an agunah cannot remarry until she receives a get. She cannot remarry Jewishly. If an agunah does not comply with this state of affairs and marries civilly without a get and then gives birth to a child, the child of that forbidden union is considered a mamzer, a child of a forbidden union. So the fallout from igun is obviously can be multi-generational. Tonight we want to look at certain questions. Are there workable solutions to this crisis? Are there methods available that are not being employed? Is it a problem that is inherent in Jewish law and hence resistant to any easy solution? Or does the problem lie with a lack of rabbinic initiative, captured in Blue Greenberg's famous phrase, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way? How is the situation in the land of Israel different than that of the diaspora? And what is the relationship between religious and secular law in this area? Our speakers tonight have worked assiduously and honorably in the area of igun, and it is my pleasure to introduce them to you in alphabetical order. Sitting next to me, Dr. Rachel Levmore, as an active rabbinical court advocate since 1995, she specialized in cases of igun and get refusal heard by the Israeli rabbinical courts. In January 2000, she became the first woman to join the Agunot unit in the directorate of the Israeli rabbinical courts. She's the coordinator for matters of igun and get refusal in a Council of Young Israel Rabbis project sponsored by the Jewish Agency. In that capacity, she's helped hundreds of women attain their freedom from the untenable chains that bound them. She was one of a team that developed a prenup agreement for the prevention of get refusal, and her research on the subject was documented in her master's thesis in Talmud at Bar-Ilan. Next to me, Ms. Sharon Shore is a partner at Epstein Cole with a focus on family law. She's worked on cases at all levels of court in Ontario, including the Court of Appeal. Ms. Shore has authored and co-authored several articles on family law issues. She was an instructor for the family law section of the Bar Admission course for the Law Society of Upper Canada. She holds a degree in political science from York and an LLB from Osgoode Hall Law School, is the immediate past president of Jewish Family and Child Service of Greater Toronto, is also the editor of B'nai B'rith Law Journal, Family Law Editions, and is an executive member of TASC, the Toronto Aguna Support Coalition. On the left here, Rabbi Jeremy Stern is the executive director of ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. ORA is a not-for-profit organization which assists divorcing couples in resolving contested Jewish divorces in a timely fashion and in accordance with halakha. Since its founding in 2002, ORA has assisted in the resolution of over 170 disputed divorce cases and is currently working on 70 open cases. ORA provides its services free of charge. It operates under the guidance of Rav Herschel Schachter, the Rosh Hashiva of Reed Seminary at YU, and in cooperation with an extensive team of attorneys, rabbis, mental health professionals. And to my right, Rabbi Shlomo Weissman is the director of the Beit Din of America. Since its inception nearly 50 years ago, the Beit Din has been recognized as one of the nation's preeminent rabbinic courts. It serves the Jewish community of North America as a forum for obtaining Jewish divorces, confirming personal status, and adjudicating commercial disputes stemming from divorce, business, and community issues. Please welcome our speakers. Okay, I thought we'd go in chronological order, actually, and start kind of before the marriage. Let's begin with that state before the man and woman get married, when, of course, like all couples, there's optimism and faith that the match will last forever. At that moment, it would seem to be very awkward to introduce a document which alludes to the potential breakup of that union. Yet, recently, there's been increasing talk and, in fact, action on the idea of a prenuptial agreement as a means of counteracting the agunah problem. So I'd like to ask if you could explain, perhaps we'll start with Rabbi Weissman and move along, how the prenup works in America, and we can also speak to Canada, whether it can be effective in counteracting igun, and if it is effective, why it is opposed in certain rabbinic circles.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, before I begin, to Rabbi Kelman and to Torah in Motion for hosting this important event. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Let me start by just giving a background for those who are not familiar with the structure of the prenup. I'm falling through the stage. The prenuptial agreement that is promulgated by the Beth Din of America and that's been endorsed by the Rabbinical Council of America traces its roots to the mid-1990s when Rabbi Mordechai Willig, in consultation with a number of lawyers and rabbinic scholars as well, developed this prenuptial agreement based on precedent that goes back several hundred years earlier than that and articles that were written several decades ago. And the prenuptial agreement that he developed in consultation with these scholars essentially consists of two provisions. One is an arbitration provision, which provides that in the event of divorce, where either of the spouses is interested in obtaining a get or in either giving or receiving a get, it names a particular Beit Din that has jurisdiction to handle issues relating to the get. The second provision of the prenup is that the husband obligates himself to support his wife at the rate of $150 per day, indexed to inflation as of the date of the marriage, for so long as they are separated, or from the time they are separated, and for so long as they remain married as a matter of Jewish law, which basically means that he's on the hook to support her for $150 a day, which translates to about $52,000 a year, until he gives the get, until they're divorced as a matter of Jewish law. This prenup, as you can imagine, provides an incentive for the husband to give a get early in the process, as soon as they are separated, as soon as it's clear that there's no hope of reconciliation, and it's clear they're getting divorced. And the prenup has been enormously successful over the past 20 years or so in providing for a smooth resolution of the get issue in instances where couples who have signed the prenup are getting divorced. All the time we handle situations where it's clear that a husband is thinking about holding up the get, where the get could potentially provide a problem in their divorce negotiations, where it could possibly provide an avenue for extortion. And once the prenup is laid on the table, once it's clear to the husband that the wife has a prenup in her hand, that she's going to enforce its provisions and that the Beit Din is going to enforce its provisions, he stands down and gives the get in a timely manner. When people ask about statistics, we tell them that it's been 100% effective because there's no case in which a valid prenup has been signed and a get was withheld for an undue amount of time. Certainly there's no case where the get was held past the time of the civil divorce. So it's a record that we are particularly proud of at the Beth Din of America because we are the, so to speak, the authors of the prenup where the Beit Din named in the prenup. And it's really, from my vantage point, the only real effective long-term solution to the Aguna problem.
So
let me get to your question now.
Right. Well, I mean, in other words, so it sounds very effective, but there's obviously opposition.
So the opposition.
What's the basis of that?
So before I talk about the opposition, let me talk about the community that's accepted it. The Rabbinical Council of America, which is the largest rabbinical organization in the world with about 1,000 rabbi members, which just colloquially we'll associate with, let's say, the Yeshiva University, OU, centrist Orthodox community, has endorsed the prenup, has urged its members not to officiate at weddings unless the prenup's used. So that community, to a very large degree, has embraced the prenup and encourages or urges its members to use the prenup, not to get married without a prenup. There are communities, let's say, again, just to use the term, to the right of that world, among more, let's say, Haredi communities, where the prenup hasn't really taken a stronghold. And the reason has less, I think, to do with halachic opposition, because there hasn't really been any strong halachic opposition articulated. The reason is more or less, from what I could tell, cultural. The reasons people give is that it's not nice to talk about divorce to a young couple getting married just before their wedding. Recently, a prominent personality within the Haredi community in the United States told me that he personally finds the prenup difficult because he thinks that it might lead couples to get divorced quicker than they should, a marriage that might have been salvaged if the get was in the mix. If the woman realizes that she could get the get when she wants it, she might not work as hard to try to salvage the marriage. There are all sorts of reasons that are given. But I think what they all boil down to, because if you really think of it, in my view, none of these reasons are really very compelling. I think it's because of a cultural reticence to introduce changes in age-old traditions surrounding Jewish marriage. That's really what it boils down to, I think. And unfortunately, that's something that, you know, some segments of our community hold on to, I think, more readily or more forcefully than other segments of our community. My hope is that in the long run, as this problem continues to present itself, and as the prenup continues to work and resolve cases quickly, the communities that have adopted the prenup can serve as a model to the communities that are more reluctant to adopt it, to show that this is a real solution that works in the real world and that it's really the only way to go.
Okay. So the prenuptial agreement has been very effective in the United States. The problem is that in Canada, approximately 4 years ago, our laws changed, and really changed as a result of Sharia law, but affected Jewish law as well. And what the law now says is any family law matter going before an arbitrator, which is what a Beit Din is, has to go before a deemed family law arbitrator and has to be determined in accordance with family law, the family law of Ontario. So what they effectively did was take away from the hands of the Beit Din under civil law to make any binding agreements. And because of that, any arbitration agreement or marriage contract that somebody enters into to submit an issue to the Beit Din would not be valid because the Beit Din in Toronto are not qualified family law arbitrators. We have looked at the idea of having them qualified as family law arbitrators. I just think it becomes too complicated. And what do they do when halakha and Ontario family law conflict with one another? So the Beit Din of America has this great prenuptial agreement. What do we do if we can't use it here? So there have been some family law lawyers and some rabbis who have looked at this issue. We can certainly say that the parties agree to submit the issue of the get to the Beit Din, because the get is not something that falls under family law. It's not something a judge could order. So you can have a very simple agreement that says, we will submit the issue of facilitation, or we agree to attend before the Beit Din in the event of a breakdown of the marriage for the purpose of facilitating the get. They can't agree in advance to give the get, but they can agree to attend before the Beit Din to facilitate the get. We can also give the Beit Din rights to both arbitrate and determine issues of both cost and damages. At the moment, this agreement doesn't work, and there are still some problems that need to be ironed out. I think one is a cultural shift that Rabbi Weissman was talking about. I think there has been some reluctance from the, whether it's the Beit Din here or some of the rabbis here, to allow prenuptial agreements here, because we haven't used them in the past, and we'll certainly be looking to leadership from the Beit Din of America and other rabbis who have accepted it to come and show some leadership and speak to our rabbis here to allow it to become the norm. But I think even though it doesn't have the bite, or it won't have the bite of this support provision, and it won't have an automatic economic consequence, I still think it's a document worth having. It's certainly something we should be speaking to our rabbis about and getting them used to the idea of having a very simple agreement. I think that if somebody's already willing to turn their mind to it before a marriage and sign some sort of agreement, they are probably more likely than not to give the get than if they hadn't turned their mind to it before, there was no discussion, and they now think that this is a tool that they can use. I also think in Canada we have some other remedies available to us that I think we're going to talk about later, so I'm not going to get into them now. But I think it's probably worth having something here, even though it's not going to have the same effect or ramifications that the RCA agreement is going to have.
As Rabbi Weissman explained, the Beit Din of America's agreement is based on spousal support. In Israel, we've used the same mechanism and expanded the prenuptial agreement, which is called in English the Agreement for Mutual Respect. In Hebrew, Hesken LeKavod Hadadi. It's a reciprocal agreement, and it includes in it a slightly different structure, but the mechanism is the same, based on an obligation in the case of get refusal to support the spouse at a high level. In our agreement, it can go up to 50% of the average monthly income of the person who's refusing to give the get. It has not been around as long as the agreement of the Beit Din of America, but it has already proven to be effective in that there have been several couples where the man initially refused to give a get, and most of the time he's very young and sort of like doesn't relate to reality. And then when someone explains to him, listen, if you don't give the get now, in 6 months' time, there's a difference between that and the Beit Din of America, in 6 months' time, you're going to owe a minimum of $1,500 a month to the woman that left you. What do you need that for? She's going to turn you into a cash cow. So immediately, he sees a way out of the impending threat of losing all that money, so he gives the get in a matter of a few weeks. And the Batei Din were aware of, in several cases, that it was the agreement for mutual respect that brought the young man to give the get, and they just didn't want to talk about it. They just arranged the get on the spot. The situation in Israel is very different from the situation here in regards to the Beit Din, the rabbinical court, because the rabbinical court in Israel is part of the justice system. The dayanim, the rabbinical court judges, have the same powers that any judge that you can picture have, you know, they can order your arrest, they can take away they can fine you, they can trash the title on your home, they can incarcerate you, et cetera, take away your driver's license if you're a get refuser. But those same rabbis are very uncomfortable with the concept of the prenuptial agreement, very, very uncomfortable with it, and they will make all sorts of claims as to why it's not halachic, which aren't very well based. But what underlies it basically is that they're uncomfortable with the prenuptial agreement for the same reason that Rabbi Weissman brought up, is that culturally it's way out of the ballpark. It's very strange to them, and they find it disturbing that young people, in particular, should decide for themselves when they want to get a divorce, or that anybody should decide for themselves, and also very disturbing that women should decide for themselves when it's proper to get a divorce, because they're used to doing that. In other words, you cannot get a civil divorce or a religious divorce, it's one and the same, in Israel, without going to the Beit Din Rabbani and convincing the Beit Din through a fault divorce. There's no such thing as no fault divorce. You have to prove fault and convince the Beit Din that a divorce is in order here, unless the divorce is done by agreement. And if a woman is suing for divorce, or a man, our agreement is reciprocal, as I said, they want to be able to have a very large say, and say, well, you should get divorced or you shouldn't get divorced. And if the couple comes, at the end of the day, agreeing to divorce, they sort of like don't have anything to do. They don't have a job. And so that's the basis of the discomfort that the Beit Din in Israel have with the divorce. Afterwards, I'd like to address the issue of a different type of prenuptial agreement.
Okay, we'll get back to you. So just before we go, I see two issues here that are emerging. One is a cultural issue, one's a financial issue. If I understand you correctly, theoretically, if a person was wealthy enough and spiteful enough, the prenup will be irrelevant, right? In other words, if you don't mind taking a $50,000 hit for eternity, you can do that. That's not the fault of the prenup. It's just that's a reality.
Yes, although we found that even very wealthy people don't like paying $52,000 to their ex-spouse each year. It's in our experience.
Especially in a contentious divorce, meaning when it's coming to a situation where it's so acrimonious that he's refusing to give a get, people will fight over nickels and dimes.
Right.
And even in a very wealthy couple, $50,000 plus a year is going to be pretty hefty.
And that's true on the other end also. People who are destitute, that are judgment-proof because they have no money, also don't like judgments against them to pay money to their ex-spouses.
That's true. Okay, I hear. And then there's the cultural problem. And I'm wondering, how do you overcome that cultural problem? Right, I've heard this 3 times here now, right? You know, they're not used to it. So what can be done about that?
So education is a huge element, and that's something that we really focus on at ORAP, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. We have an educational program that we bring to Jewish high schools and on college campuses and schools and communities, trying to standardize the use of the halachic prenup. Our catch line is, friends don't let friends get married without the halachic prenup. And what I say to audiences all the time is, whether speaking to parents of children who are, in the parsha of getting engaged and getting married, that you say to your child, very happy to support you through your marriage, and we'll help you in whatever way we can at the wedding, as long as you sign a halachic prenuptial agreement. That's the expectation we have of rabbis. We should expect that of ourselves as well, just like we want the rabbis to only officiate at weddings. And so, too, I say to younger couples and to people who are in their early 20s, if your friend says to you, I want you to be a bridesmaid or a groomsman or an aid kiddushin or an aid chuppah or whatever it is, aid yichud, you say, I'd love to, I'm so honored, thank you, as long as you sign a halachic prenuptial agreement. And if we can not only work from the top down and try to encourage all rabbis and require of all rabbis to only officiate at weddings if a halachic prenuptial agreement is signed, so too we can work from the bottom up and trying to create a communal standard to break that stigma. And I think we're, you know, our office is based at Yeshiva University. We're separate from the university, but we see YU students all the time. And we're starting to see a real culture change and the programming that we're doing at YU and other campuses, and really trying to standardize it.
And I think they've been very successful at bringing about that culture change. I've been called numerous times to the bayit. I don't live near here, so I haven't come to Shir HaShamayim, but to the bayit where people are getting married from their rabbi, either from Israel or usually from the United States, who's coming here to marry the couple, who will present the prenup to them, and they need to get independent legal advice, so they sort of know to give me a call and I'll do it. But there are a number of people who certainly come here and just say, it's so accepted there, we have to sign it. So there certainly is a culture shift that we're seeing south of the border that's beginning to leak up north of the border, which is great, good for you guys.
In Israel, we did actually start at the grassroots. We intentionally did not go to the big rabbanim because we knew that it would be a matter of... we did go to one big rav, and we stuck with him and developed a prenuptial together with him. That was Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. But we didn't turn to anyone else, and we just did education of all Jews at the grassroots. I say all Jews because in Israel, all Jews, if they get married under the auspices of the state, get married in accordance with halakha and with an Orthodox marriage, even if they're just traditional or secular or agnostic or what have you, they're all in need of it, not only the Orthodox. But once we passed a certain tipping point of like the academic world and the modern, religious Zionist world became very aware after 10 years of doing education of the prenuptial agreement, then I published a book under the auspices of two rabbinic organizations, one of which was Mostot Ariel, which is a recognized training institute in Beit Vagan for Rabbanim and Dayanim, and they put out a halachic book, a Sefer Halacha, by a woman, Vani, was kept top secret until it was actually bound because we figured that they were going to get ricochets, as we say, and objections to it because they printed a halachic book by a woman. And that book, called Min'i Enayich Midim'a, was written in the language of the Rabbanim. As I say, it's a Sefer Halacha, and it goes through all of prenuptial agreements and analyzes and everything that they need to know is in there because they really don't know anything about the halachot of prenuptial agreements. Never occurred to them to learn it. So here we go, and it presents all the different sides. And it was mailed by Mostot Ariel in their envelope, this is relevant, to 1,000 rabbanim in Israel. And it was read. In other words, all the dayanim got it, the rabbinical court judges, all the Rashi Yeshivot Hesder, the Yeshivot Hesder themselves, Midrashot, Mechinot, in the marriage registrars, Tohar rabbis, 1,000 rabbanim, which also included some who were not rabbanim, the Supreme Court judges, the family court judges. It had an effect. It had an effect. It was mailed out in the summer of 2009, and we get anecdotal evidence that of couples that go and they say, we want a prenuptial agreement, we want to sign the Hesken Lekvod Haradi, and we hear stories of how the book, the rabbi will wave the book at them and say, I didn't know anything about prenups. If you would have come to me, you know, a year ago, I would have said, no way, but I'm in the middle of learning this book. And he goes goes ahead with it. So that's the way to affect rabbis.
Okay, so here we've been talking about a world where we have prenuptial, but let's talk about the world where we don't, which is quite a lot of that world. I want to focus on something that you have written, Dr. Lev Moore, where you've written that the fear of pressuring a husband to the point that the get will be considered forced, me'useh, which may cause it to be invalid with terrible consequences, has led to rabbinic hesitancy and at times even paralysis. Moreover, even if a Beit Din today anywhere in the world were to rule for coercion of a get against a recalcitrant husband, it could not use physical coercion for fear of being charged with assault and battery. Although the halakha may allow the rabbis to beat or whip a disobedient person, human rights, societal norms, and most importantly, civil law do not allow anything of the sort. On this point, civil law ties the hands of rabbinic judges. Unquote. In addition to this, Actually, not that long ago. In addition to this, you've noted two other differences with secular law, that halakha demands, as you said before, that the woman provide cause for divorce, and that two judges in secular court on their own power can change the personal status of the couple from married to divorced, whereas in Jewish law it still comes down to the husband giving the get. And without that, there's nothing that Dayanim can do to change personal status. So my question to all of you is as follows. We'll start over here. Although there are a lot of complaints about rabbinic inaction in the area of Igun, and we'll follow up on that in a little bit, but what you have written suggests that no matter what rabbis do, in the end, we still have to wait each and every time for the husband to give the get. So I'm wondering if you see this as a bit of a structural problem or even a flaw in the halakha itself.
It's true. The Torah requires a husband to give a get, meaning a divorce can't happen without a husband willingly giving a get. But it's important, and that's true, that's an immutable fact. There's nothing we could do about that. The Torah is a divine document. We accept it without question. We might know the reasons for some of the mitzvot in the Torah. We might not know the reasons for others, but we deal with the Torah as it is. The problem that presents itself in our day is that society has changed drastically in many, many ways. First of all, divorce rates are way higher than they ever were. But more importantly for our problem, society has changed in the sense that we no longer live in autonomous communities governed by strong batei din. In the old days, you couldn't get away with withholding a get, because if you did, there was nowhere else to move. You couldn't integrate in secular society because they wouldn't have you. We're talking about, you know, pre-emancipation. You couldn't move anywhere because there was little mobility, and you'd have to do what the rabbi told you to do. You'd be in big trouble if you didn't, and that's why all the tshuvot you read about from hundreds of years ago relating to agunot have to do with husbands lost at sea, not with husbands who are not willing to give a get. And so the problem we face today is that we live in a society where anyone could do whatever they want or not do what they want. They could integrate into society. They could flout the batei din. They could simply ignore what their halakhic responsibilities are. And the solutions traditionally to drastic change, societal changes that cause severe halakhic problems, all traditionally have been, you restructure things, you tinker with the economics, you do things like what we've tried to do with the prenup in order to re-incentivize things properly, get husbands to listen to the batei din when the batei din tell them to give a get. That's traditionally been the solution. Now, I realize Canada is a little more complicated, but at least in the United States, that's really been an effective solution. And so that's my answer to the question of whether there's a structural Torah problem here. The Torah says what it says. It's up to the rabbis and to us to figure out ways to creatively address the problem and get our society in line with the structure that the Torah demands. And that's the challenge.
I'd just like to add something very interesting that occurred to me as Rabbi Weissman was speaking. I have a neighbor in Efrat who's a professor of history in Ben-Gurion University. He once told me that as he was doing his research into the responsa in Europe for over the decades, and he said he noticed a direct correlation between the number of questions that were asked of the rabbis regarding agunas and the building of the railroad throughout Europe, that as a railroad reached town, that's when it was first created, railroads, that's when the agunot problem popped up in that area, because the husbands would get on the train and go away when we're talking about mobility. So today, people can move all over. Yes, through the vehicle of divorce, you need the agreement of both the man on a divine level, Torah law, and the agreement of the woman in accordance with the Rabbeinu Gershom on a rabbinic level. So divorce today, no matter where in the world, through a get, is done only by agreement. it can't be changed by an external third party, by a judge. But what the rabbanim can do is they can use other tools to dissolve a marriage, and a different type of prenuptial agreement. Until now, until recently, the past few years, when we've said prenuptial agreement, we are referring always to a monetary document. So, but now there's another kind of document that that was authored by Rabbi Professor Michael Broyd that's called the tripartite agreement. And he's taken solutions that many times people in the audience yell out and they say, well, what about a kiddushin al tznai, a conditional marriage? And somebody else will yell out, well, what about a conditional divorce, right? Or permission to give a divorce. Well, what about like prosbul? Why not takanat kahal of some sort, or takanat hachamim? You know, people call out, and each one of those solutions has very deep halachic problems with it, and very unlikely for all of the Jewish communities and their rabbanim to agree on any one single one of those solutions. And this tripartite document, it was originally made of three parts. Now it has more than three parts to it, but in English we still call it a tripartite document. It actually combines all of those suggestions, the basic ones being kiddushin al tznai, conditional marriage, and get v'harsha'a, permission to write a writ of divorce, to write a get, in my name, the husband says, and a takanat hakahal, a communal ordinance that in the community I belong to, if a wife asks for a get, then it must be given within 15 months. Everything in that document is centered around 15 months, and I'm not going to go into the halachic mechanisms now, but the existence of all three of these features together in a single document actually strengthens each one of the other features and overcomes the halachic problems that each one of them would have if they would stand alone. It's sort of like if you take a braid, and instead of having a single strand, which is rather weak, if you pull it, it may snap, but if you braid three strands together and you pull it, it is very, very strong. That's the effect of this document. This document is starting to spread. It's not being disseminated or educated about in the same manner as the monetary prenuptial agreement for a variety of reasons, but in cases both in the United States and in Israel, it has been signed. It's fortunately it's never had to be tested yet, but we believe that this whole situation is a b'dieved situation. See, another, we were saying that there's a cultural problem. The problem is even deeper than that in a halachic sense, in a meta-halachic sense, that the rabbanim look at any new question, they look at it as a lechatchila, a priori, like how would we like it really to be? And we don't really want prenuptial agreements, but the rabbanim that are cognizant of the fact that we sort of, we live in a time of shat hadchak, of a very pressurized, imperfect world situation, and it's a b'dieved situation. And if you actually end up having naguna, it's a b'dieved shebediyeved situation, then they will resort to unconventional means to free an aguna, and that's what this document, that upon that premise, this document is based.
But it ends up talking, I mean, what you're really saying, all of you, is that there's a kind of structural non-fit now because of modernity. In other words, Jewish divorce law would seem to operate best in the area or the arena of a closed community where refusal to give a get would have serious or even crippling consequences socially for the man who lived in that kind of small, even ghettoized community, and he had nowhere to run or hide, right? So now the law is far more constrained or even impotent in a modern world where he basically has a lot more mobility and the fear of social ostracization is much less. So in a way now you're really working extremely handicapped from the get-go because of the modern circumstance. And I know you've actually worked with some high-profile cases. There are a couple of very high-profile cases now in America. There's Gitel Dodelson and Tamar Epstein. So we're really now saying that we're trying to use other means to create this kind of pressure, right? So I want to know from you, Rabbi Stern, what do you see as the current role of the community in helping to assist Agunot? And I guess really what I'm interested in is social pressure on a recalcitrant husband really effective in an open society?
Okay, so I'll get to that question, but I want to address the understanding that you presented behind it, which is that we've been talking about the pressure that can be applied against a recalcitrant husband. But I think a critical element here is also what's empowering him to refuse to give a get. Certainly in terms of applying pressure, I guess that's the question most directly. In terms of applying pressure, thank God, we've assisted in the resolution, some updated numbers from the intro. We've assisted in the resolution of 207 Aguna cases since we started in 2002. At any given time, we're working on about, now it's mostly the hardened criminals, about 50 active Aguna cases. We get about 150 to 200 calls every year for assistance and guidance from women looking for assistance in the get process, in the Beit Din process. But we have seen the pressure that we're able to apply, whether it's rallying a community in a peaceful demonstration outside the home or the office or place of business or the shul or whatever it is, where the recalcitrant spouse, almost exclusively the husband, is found. Applying pressure financially, if there's anything that can be done in civil courts. Socially, pressure from family and friends in his community. Pressure from a shul that he shouldn't be given honors in a shul. We try and apply whatever pressure we can to try and make it no longer worth his time to refuse to give the get. And thank God, often we're successful. Often we have to continue building up the pressure and hoping that eventually it'll be the straw that will break the camel's back. We've had cases where it was, one case in particular is 20 rallies before the guy gave a get. And someone may have turned to us after rally 18 or 19 and said, 18 rallies, 19 rallies, he hasn't given the get. The 20th rally, he said, Bo my van nafish, I've had enough, and I'm really tired of having these YU guys outside my home every year of Shabbos. And so he decided to give the get, and so that's what we hope will happen in some of these hardened criminals, these really difficult cases. But going back to what I started saying in the beginning, is that in addition to the pressure that can be applied, we also have to consider what's empowering these husbands. And what we often see, especially in these high-profile cases, you talk about Aaron Friedman, who works for a congressman in Washington, D.C., for the first 2 years after their separation. Tamar was told, and while they were adjudicating their divorce in civil court, Tamar was told, don't ask for the get, wait for after the civil divorce. He says he'll give it at the end of the civil divorce. That put his feet in concrete. And even after that, and for quite a while, as we were advocating on behalf of Tamar, there were so many people, his family members and friends and even some rabbis, who were saying, well, he has claims for why he doesn't want to give the get. There's some justification for him not giving a get. There are two sides to every story, which we hear all the time. And it was the same story over again with the case of Gital Dorelson and Avram Meir Weiss, which made the papers the past 2 months. And she lives in Lakewood. He lives in Staten Island. And in that situation as well, Avram Meir Weiss has his family, his friends, and the entire borough of Staten Island, basically, that is defending him, supporting him, excusing and justifying his refusal to give a get. And I feel, from the cases that we've seen, that the approbation that recalcitrant husbands receive from their family, friends, community members, in refusing to give a get, really is what empowers them. And so I think what we can do as a community, in addition to trying to prevent 99.9% or 100% of Aguna cases with the implementation of the RCA, Halachic Prenuptial Agreements, or other forms of that agreement, is also changing this dynamic, changing our community's attitude towards get refusal. Fundamentally, the refusal to issue a get. There are several motivations why a husband may refuse to give a get. Money, child custody, visitation, spite, or trying to force her back into the relationship. All sorts of motivations that a husband may have in refusing to give a get. Fundamentally, everything is about control. He's trying to control her, whether to extract concessions from her, financial concessions, custodial concessions, control her to pain her, to harm her out of spite, or to control her, to force her back into a relationship she's not interested in being in. And it's for that reason that the refusal to issue a get is a form of domestic abuse. And that's the message we need to get out there. Domestic abuse is defined as a pattern of controlling behavior. And that's what we need to educate our children about, our students about. That domestic abuse is not just about black and blue marks, it's about a pattern of controlling behavior. And that's exactly what get refusal is. And just like we would never excuse a man beating his wife, so too we can never excuse a man refusing to give his wife a get. They're both forms of domestic abuse, and domestic abuse is never justified. Once we can take away that power and that empowerment the husband receives in refusing to give a get, then he's going to be standing alone. And it's much, much harder to stand alone when you have your entire community and your family and friends all telling you what you're doing is wrong. And it's not easy. I'm sure it's not easy. If you have a family member, you have a son, an uncle, a cousin, even your son, who's not doing the right thing, you have to stand up and say, this is abuse, and I can't tolerate that. I can't condone that. This is something that we must stand against. And what we need to do is shift in our community's perspective on get refusal from there are two sides to every story. Yes, when it comes to adjudicating issues of finances and custody, there are two sides to every story. Or sometimes they say there are three sides, his side, her side, and the truth. Okay, three sides to every story. But when it comes to domestic abuse, there are no two sides in domestic abuse. Domestic abuse is never justified. Get refusal is never justified. And if we can change that paradigm within our community, I think that would go a very long way in addressing this issue.
I think one of the things that Jeremy was talking about was, you know, as a community, or what we were asked is, as a community, what effect or can we have on the individual refusing to give a get? And there's an interesting dynamic that takes place, because I agree with everything that Jeremy said, that we need to change the attitude of people. Every time we have somebody who's refusing to give the get, the response back is always, well, there are two sides to every story. Okay, there are no two sides to this story. There are issues that can be negotiated. There is give and take. But I have had people say to me, well, if he's going to give her the get, why shouldn't he get something in return? It is completely an issue of control. 85% of the cases that I deal with are not Jewish cases or Orthodox cases in my practice. Abuse is abuse. The pattern is there. The issue of control is there. I recognize it, whether it's a Jewish issue or a non-Jewish issue, but withholding a get is absolutely about control. Just as somebody who's got financial control of a wife, somebody who's got emotional control or physical control or abuse over a spouse, and that we as a community have to stop saying, but there are two sides to every story, he only wants dot, dot, dot. We currently have a case going on right now in the community where a get is, where a get is being withheld, and the answer back from the Beit Din was, well, he only wants X amount of dollars, it's not a lot, somebody should just pay it and be done. And this was an abused spouse. And you almost turn around and cringe and say, how on earth can you expect this woman to hand over money to her husband simply to get a get? It's perpetuating the abuse. It shouldn't be tolerated. But the answer from the Beit Din is there are two sides to every story, and it's not a lot of money, and why shouldn't she do it? She's getting something that she wants. It's just not appropriate. But here's the problem. When as a community we want to take action, people always ask the question, has a hazmana been issued against the husband? Okay, which is an invitation for the husband to appear in front of the Beit Din. In Toronto, our Beit Din is divided into two Beit Dins. There's the Beit Din that deals just with Gitin, and then there's the Beit Din that deals with all financial matters. The Beit Din in Toronto that is set up just to deal with Gitin does not have the facilities or the ability to issue hazmanot. So that if they want to issue a hazmanah, you actually have to go over to the other Beit Din and ask them to issue the hazmanah over there. But that is the financial Beit Din and not the Gitin Beit Din. So I think there needs to be a structural change to the way that they're set up here. In the 15 years that I have been doing this, I have never seen a hazmanah issued against a husband to attend just in front of the Gitin Beit Din. The problem with that is when I have a husband who is refusing to give a get, and I go to a rabbi and I say to the rabbi, don't give this man kibbutim in shul, the first thing they ask me is, well, has a chasmana been issued and has he refused to listen to it? I can never answer that in the positive because of the way that our system is set up. And that is definitely something that needs to change. I don't know if it's an issue of financial resources or what it is, but it's certainly something, some sort of dialogue that needs to go on. But as a community, the question is, do we need, if we're not set up to issue hazmanot in our Beit Din here, do we really need to wait, or is there some other objective way to determine whether or not the husband is withholding a get other than some crazy woman running around saying that he's refusing to give a get? But I think the answer really does lie in social pressure, not allowing it to be a social norm, not accepting, you know, along the lines of what Jeremy said, not accepting that there are two sides to every story, and really using the tagline that withholding a get is a form of domestic abuse. We're not set up in this city yet to deal with these issues, and I have to tell you, there are a handful of people out there. We have 5 cases on the go right now of women who really need our assistance and really need our help, and we just don't have the resources to do it.
I just want to follow up with you just in the Toronto context for 2 reasons. One is that Rabbi Kellen and I were told that there's no Aguna problem in Toronto by the rabbis of the city. Of course, it's also true that someone once said there are no homosexuals in Iran. So anyway, Hamevin Yavin. It doesn't seem to me, I mean, this is the first that I've heard of this two Beit Bati Din. It doesn't seem to me, perhaps I'm being simple-minded, that it's a huge deal for the left hand to tell the right hand to issue a hazmanah. Is it that complicated? That's my first question. And my second question, and here I'd like to move outside of the rabbinic context, is Rabbi Stern was talking about these continuous rallies that go on in New York that he marshals. And what's your conception of the Toronto community and how passive or active, quietistic or assertive they are in this regard?
So I'm naive. I'm going to start with your second question, and you'll have to remind me of your first
one. I will.
I'm naive, and I like to believe that if there was a need and if there was a time that we were going to actually rally outside, that we would be able to get individuals out there. I don't think we're going to get hundreds of people, but I certainly think that there are a core group of people in Toronto who are aware of the issues and feel passionate about the issues, and that we would be able to get a core group of people. And if not, I bribe my friends. It's easy enough. You know, I belong to a shul where they are quite, and there are a number of synagogues where they're quite, I mean, Shari Shemaim is one of them as well, where they're quite civic-minded and quite involved in issues. So I really do like to believe that there is a core group out there.
Why can't the first Beit Din tell the second Beit Din, issue a hazmanah?
Just before I answer.
Yeah.
The other thing is, one of the things that we have found is very helpful is very often just the pressure of going public has been very helpful. So we haven't done any rallies because some of the cases we've been dealing with, just saying to the husband, by the way, we're going to picket outside the school that you teach at. Oh, by the way, we're going to picket outside your apartment or your place of work has been successful. And sometimes actually going through with it is not going to be as effective as just holding the thread over. So why does the left hand not talk to the right hand? I don't know. I just know in 15 years, the one hazmanah I saw issued was against a woman, and there was a financial issue involved. There's a case now where they have said go to the other Beit Din, but also because they're tying, they've come up with a financial issue for them to deal with. But they have said straight out to me, they do not issue. I mean, they said they do, and then they say they don't. They haven't issued any hazmanot, and in some very clear cases where the husband is withholding a get.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing I wanted, now that we've sort of switched topics a little bit, I just wanted to pick up on something Rabbi Stern mentioned, and that is the importance of the community coming together. And I think that, and this is something that Rabbi Stern and I have discussed among ourselves as well, it's also important to realize the central role that Batei Din and that Rabbanim, rabbis within communities, play in this. Meaning, any situation in which sort of people will just come up from the ground up and rally spontaneously in order to ensure that getting or given is potentially doomed to failure. You need a broad-based strategy that brings all of the players into the process. You need Batei Din to be on board in order to issue Seiruvin where appropriate. You need rabbis on board in order to put their imprimatur on the effort. It needs to be a broad-based coalition that rises up and acts forcefully, not only because unity is an important value in its own right, but also because that's the way you're really going to be assured of success. If it's just individuals rallying against an individual, but without any sort of framework that makes it clear that this person is a misarvan, that he has refused to give a get, you're going to be attacked for bothering a poor, innocent person who's involved in a contentious divorce. There needs to be an integrated approach. I think that's important, and I think it speaks to the importance of all of the community working together with the rabbis, with the Batei Din, in a unified fashion altogether. The other thing also, you know, relevant to Rabbi Stern's position, call for a change in attitudes is, and I sound like a broken record because I keep on getting back to the prenup, but one of the effects that we've seen of the prenup is that it has the effect of changing the cultural attitude towards the use of the get or the inappropriateness of the use of the get as a tool for extortion or for negotiation leverage. A few years ago, we had a case in which a couple signed the prenup at the time they got married. They later on were headed towards divorce, you know, maybe a decade after they originally got married, and the wife had lost the prenup. There was no prenup. The rabbi who had officiated at the wedding didn't send a copy to the Beth Din of America. We didn't have one on file. He lost his files. There was no prenup to be found. Everyone knew that a prenup had been signed, but it was simply lost. And we were told that this was going to be a difficult case. The husband had all sorts of issues that he had on the table. He had threatened use of the get as a point of leverage. But ultimately what happened is the rabbi sat down with the husband and he looked him in the eye and he said, "You are a member of a community that insists that prenups be signed. You signed a prenup at your wedding, which was essentially a promise that you wouldn't withhold the get from your wife." Now, keep in mind, this was a prenup that couldn't have been enforced because it was lost. And yet the husband immediately gave a get because he understood that this is just not done in our community. We don't withhold getting. We're a community that signs prenups. It was, I think, an important cultural effect that the prenup has that sometimes is overlooked. And it gets to Rabbi Stern's point that we need a cultural shift, a cultural change in attitudes.
Okay, I have both one comment and one quick question. It was interesting that a minute ago you said that you have been told that there are no agunot in Toronto. I think this comes because there are different definitions of what an aguna is. And very often the definition that a Beit Din will hold is somebody where has manot have been issued, the husband hasn't responded, and therefore that person is an aguna. What do you do if you live in a city where no hasmanot are issued? You're right, we have no agunot. But I can certainly tell you there are women in this room today, there are women I spoke to earlier today, there are women I speak to, at least five or six off the top of my head, on a regular basis, who are actual and what I would define as real agunot, who want their get. Weeks have passed, months have passed, in some cases years have passed, and they are still considered agunot. Just to drive one point home, Jeremy, in all the cases where you guys picket or take action, do you always have hasmanot issued, and is there always either a siruv out there, or do you have some Beit Din who has said this person is withholding a get?
It's a good question, and I think that we're seeing a difference perhaps between Rabbi Weissman and Sharon in this approach, and Ora might take a thin line a little bit between the two, in that Rav Herschel Schachter, Rosh Kol El YU, is our posik, and any issue that comes up halachically, we will consult with Rav Schachter, and we won't take any action that may have any sort of halachic implications without consulting with Rav Schachter. And I agree that that's critical. It is always our preference to try and work with the community rabbis and the community Batei Din, because that's generally going to be the most... The more people you can get on board, that's going to be the more effective way to get things done. That being said, our most difficult situations are situations where the either rabbis are supporting the recalcitrant husbands, or there's been just to add another element of why the halachic prenup is so effective is because the two, and I'll get back to, I'll tell you why I'm tying this in, the two sides agree from the very beginning that they will go to one specific Beit Din in the event of divorce, to the Beit Din of America that we love and respect very much. And so that eliminates so much heartache in cases that we see where we can't get a Beit Din to issue a hazmana or a seiruv because the wife says she wants to go to, say, the Beit Din of America. The husband wants to go to some other Beit Din, let's say in Brooklyn, that's less reputable. And she can't force him to go to the Beit Din of America. He can't force her to go to his Beit Din in Brooklyn. And you just have this battle of jurisdictions between the two, and the cases schlep out for years. And so we end up in this position where it's clear years have gone by. This woman absolutely immediately deserves her get and deserved it years ago. We can't get a ruling from the Beit Din. What can we do? So in that situation, we might try to turn to post-game and for them to issue a psak in that in that regard, or turn to local rabbis and try and get their support for pressure. So there are situations where we may not have a seiruv from a Beit Din through a formal Beit Din process, often because the Beit Din process has failed to produce a seiruv and it's failed for whatever reason, but we will try to get rabbinic approbation. We'll insist on getting rabbinic approbation on the work that we do to ensure that everything's done. And also to add legitimacy in trying to convince the husband and the rabbis who are supporting him that he should really give a get.
I don't know anything about the Toronto Beit Din, and I found it very interesting what Sharon said. But I think Beit Din in general there's a disconnect here. I think there's a disconnect from the way that many people, perhaps most of the people sitting in this room who came to hear us speak tonight, would view the issue of the get and how to go about arranging for the get, comparing it to the way a typical Beit Din would view the arranging of the get. And that is that a Beit Din would prefer to adjudicate the financial matters and even possibly the matters of the custody of the children alongside the giving of the get, and to do it, I'm saying this l'kaf zchut, you know, in a positive manner, to do it in a wholesome manner, that everything should be taken care of under the auspices of the Beit Din, and in a complete whole fashion. And that may be the answer why the Gittin branch of the Beit Din doesn't ever issue hasmanot, because they would prefer that the financial branch of the Beit Din issues the hasmanot. In that way, the woman by default agrees to have the Beit Din take care of the finances of the divorce. Now, in the prenuptial agreement of the Beit Din of America, there's clauses that you can opt in or not opt, choose not to opt in, and that is you before you get married, you assign as to whether you want the Beit Din to have jurisdiction over your financial matters, and if so, I mean, Rabbi Weissman can explain it better than I, in accordance with which law to, and they will handle your financial matters. But if you didn't sign on the dotted line granting the Beit Din that jurisdiction, then I think that the assumption of the couple that's divorcing is that all the financial matters and the custody of the children will take place in the civil court, in the civil family court that has jurisdiction in the country where they're living. And there's the disconnect, because the Beit Din would prefer to do it, to be in charge of everything. If I can add, the Beit Din also quietly would see that it would feel that they have more power to convince a man to give a get if they're the ones who are in charge of dividing the financial assets as well.
I think it's just a bit of a struggle here, because the Beit Din does want to exactly do that. They want to try and resolve all of the issues at once, but because of the amendments in the law, they have no authority to do it. And I think it's a little bit of a struggle, and I'm not sure that they've figured out here how to balance what they want to do and what they're permitted to do under the law. And I think it's something that has to evolve.
And from what you've described, it sounds like they haven't grappled with it yet. They haven't come to a full understanding of the difficulty that they stand in front of.
To me, it sounds like a completely broken system, frankly. I mean, it's nice to say you want a holistic solution, and that's nice, but when you have no HUSMA note issued, you have a broken system. I see no other way of describing it. In other words, you simply have a perpetual year after year after year where the man is not called to account whatsoever. So you're really talking about unofficial ways of exerting pressure. I just did want to go back to that for just a moment and follow up. Why doesn't all of this stuff, rallies and finances, constitute coercion? In other words, why does that not invalidate the get?
It gets to the definition of coercion. Rabbeinu Tam, who was one of the Tosafists, we're talking about the 1200s, instituted what are known now as the Harchakot Rabbeinu Tam, which are a series of communal sanctions that he articulated and that other later decisors articulated their own versions of it as well, that he argued do not constitute actual coercion. Coercion means, in its most literal sense, physical coercion. You hit the guy with sticks, as the Shulchan Aruch says, where in our modern dirty terminology, you put a gun or a cattle prod, I guess.
Cattle prod.
But communal sanctions are viewed as privileges rather than entitlements, meaning a person is not entitled to get an aliyah in shul. He's not entitled to be the president or a member of his shul. He's not entitled in Israel to have a driver's license. It's a privilege. And therefore, withholding a privilege, Rabbeinu Tam said, is not doesn't constitute improper coercion.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple more, and then I'd really like to throw it open to the floor, actually. Look, all of you know that there's obviously a large public perception that, along with the husbands themselves, that rabbis and rabbinic establishment are complicit in igun through indifference or through halachic conservatism or even in the worst cases of corruption and so on. I'm wondering how much you think this perception is justified and how much you think this perception is invalid. I guess I'm interested in what you do, because I'm wondering, is the very fact that there are organizations like Aura, as wonderful as the work you do is for Agunot, a kind of an implicit critique of the fact that ordinary rabbinic circles are not getting the job done?
So I think it's yes and no. If we can get every single couple to go to the Beit Din of America for every single divorce case, I think we'd be in a much, 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 much better situation. We, as much as possible, we refer our cases to the Beit Din of America. We've seen time and time again, once you can get a binding arbitration agreement signed with the Beit Din of America, the get will be issued, and it will be issued independent of the other issues. So that's the Beit Din of America. There are other Batei Din, and the way it works nowadays is any man can call himself a rabbi, and any rabbi can call himself a dayan, and any three dayanim can call themselves a Beit Din. So you have corrupt individuals, you have evil men, and not many of them, thankfully, but there are one or two guys in Muncie who we do with, who have their own Beit Din, who try to work against the work that we do and counteract any seruv that's issued by another Beit Din. No question about it, and especially in Israel, there are a lot of problems with the rabbinical court system and a disconnect between the values of the Dayanim and the values of the vast majority of Israel's of Israelis outside of the Haredi population. Now, so there's no question about that I definitely see there's a problem with the Dayanim. That being said, I think another element is the lack of enforcement power. If the system were to work well in Israel and you had a Beit Din system that was efficient and sensitive to the plight of Agunot and worked well and was responsive, then we would be in a great position in Israel, and halavai, we could have a system like that. I don't know how you feel about that, Rachel. This goes to the whole heart of should there be a state ordained rabbinic establishment in Israel, a separation between church and state in Israel. And I mean, we've seen that when you have a rabbinical court system or a beit din that works well and it's empowered through arbitration agreements or what have you, it can be extremely, extremely effective. The problem is we don't always have that. So I think that's what's at the core of the issue.
Anybody else on this one?
I think working in Toronto and having to work with the system here, I think it would be a crime to generalize. When you said, are rabbis complicit? I think there are some wonderful rabbanim in the community who do some wonderful work behind the scenes. But what you also have to appreciate is these cases tend to be incredibly time-consuming and always evolve into a life of their own. And I think many of the rabbanim here, their primary role is not to serve as a dayan. They are pulpit rabbis or teachers. And I think sort of to generalize and say they're complicit. Having said that, there are certainly things that we can and should be doing as a community that we're not. And there are certainly things, and there are certainly maybe some rabbis on the periphery. You know, the way that we're set up, it's we have three rabbanim on the Gitin Beit Din, and that sort of seems to be the end all of everything, and everybody gets deferred to that. And it might be nice to see, you know, the idea of a posek. I don't know that we have that here, and we might. You know, I'm not familiar with it. You might have a few rabbanim who would do it, but I don't necessarily know that you would have somebody who would not necessarily go against, but would take a step that, and it could just be the way that we're set up here. But I don't think they perpetuate. I don't think as a general comment you can say.
So you would say that the public perception, say that in Toronto, the rabbinic establishment is complicit, would not be a valid statement.
I don't think I would make a general statement. I think there. Look, if you want me, I can sit here and I can tell war stories. We had one case where a woman was married to an exceedingly wealthy man, and she wanted a get, and he wouldn't give it. And the rabbi we happened to be speaking with at the time said to me, "Why should he give her the get for nothing? She should give up spousal support, and she'll get the get." And I said, but he's worth millions, and she's been a stay-at-home mom and has had tons of children with him. And he said, well, she's going to get child support. And I said, Rabbi, the problem with that is the children are all in their late teens or in university. Child support is going to come to an end very soon. So you have a woman who has lived a certain lifestyle, a husband who's earning significant 6-7 figures every year for several years, and you're saying she should give up spousal support in order to get her get. And he said, yes. And I said, respectfully, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this issue. You can certainly tell stories about people who are thinking in a different realm that you're thinking. But I think we should be very hesitant to criticize the rabbinic authorities, because I think there are some wonderful rabbis out there who work on the issues as well. I'd just like to see them band together a little more.
If I may add something?
Sure.
Again, the concepts that Batei Din work with or live in, exist in, are different from our day-to-day lives. And I'll give you a classic example, that of transparency. In other words, we expect all of the governmental institutions to function under transparency. If you have, or even not a governmental institution, even a Jewish institution, if your local federation or your shul board, you expect as a member of your shul that the board would function under total transparency, because the board is representing you, and it's obvious. Like this is the way the world functions today. But Batei Din do not function in a transparent manner for 2,000 years. And it's a foreign concept to them. And here you're going to add into the mix that you're dealing with very intimate personal details in the given situations. And if you start, you can figure out who the couples are sometimes if it's within a small community. So one of the functions of certain organizations, you ask, you know, what do organizations do? So in Israel, there was one women's organization that was basically made up of lawyers, of female attorneys, They started publishing. The debate in Israel was totally a stone wall. You didn't, even though it was part of the state, you couldn't get any rulings out of them. They didn't publish the rulings properly, as one would expect. And so they collected rulings from different lawyers or different litigants and started publishing. Every couple of months, they would publish rulings of the Beit Din that they didn't get from the Beit Din. And then, lo and behold, a few years later, you can find rulings of the Israeli rabbinical courts on their website. In other words, they moved more towards transparency because they had a wake-up call from an outside organization. And I'm sure that hasn't happened yet in most of the Batei Din in the diaspora. I know, for example, that the Bethlehem of America is starting to feel that because you did put out that journal.
Right.
That's because you felt the need for transparency, for engaging the public.
Right. Well, look, we're trying to tell the public that there is a Beit Din out there, namely the Bethlehem of America, where there is transparency. We have published rules and procedures where lawyers can, there's predictability to the process. Our rules and procedures are similar in many respects to the American Arbitration Association's rules and procedures. The journal that we just started last year is an effort to try to get written decisions out there so we can build trust within the community. People can see that the decisions we issue are rational and reasoned. They're not arbitrary. And it's an uphill battle. We're trying to improve the system.
Are there questions from the floor? Can I just get a sense if anybody's going to – there's one. How many people have questions? One, two, three, four. So a whole bunch. Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up here in a couple of minutes because I'd like it to go to the floor. I just wanted to ask you about the intersection of governmental legislation mm-hmm. with halakhic legislation, whether you see it as a help or a hindrance. I know there's laws that have been devised in Ontario and in New York and so on, and I wonder if you could speak to that just okay. for a moment.
So if you take away a message from today about the civil legislation that we have in place here, my recommendation to you is use it, use it, use it, and abuse it. The law in Ontario is that if a person is withholding or refusing to remove, the language is, if a spouse is refusing to remove religious barriers, you can bring a motion before the court to strike their pleadings. It's a wonderful tool. If the parties are going to civil court and they have financial claims in front of the court and the husband has refused to participate in a get, you can go ahead and have his pleading struck so you can proceed on the financial matters without him having the ability to participate. It's a wonderful tool, and if he gives the get, the court, there are cases out there that say you're welcome to come back and nothing will be held against you. You're welcome to participate, but you have to have given the get. It's a great tool. The problem is this. I don't think enough people use it. And the other problem is, what happens if you get an order that says your pleadings are struck unless you give a get within 30 days? So the husband takes this order, goes to the Beit Din and says, I now have to give her a get. The Beit Din has turned around and said, well, you're now being coerced and the get is not being given out of free will. What we have done in some circumstances is we've been creative. In one circumstance, I said to the husband, well, it's your obligation and your duty to convince the Beit Din that you really, really want to give this get, and it has nothing to do with this order. In another circumstance, what we did was we wrote an order out, a consent order saying that the court order is null and void. We gave it to the Beit Din to hold, and they were then in control of the process, and then they allowed the husband to come forward because he knew that already the court order dismissing his claims was and could be gone, and he agreed to participate at that point with the Beit Din and give the get. My feeling is if it's there, you might as well use it, and if it causes a problem with the Beit Din, it's easier to resolve at that end than it is if you don't use it. You get everything resolved in the civil matter, in the financial matters, and then you're stuck with no ability to put any pressure on the husband. I think it's a great tool, and every time we've used it, we've been successful. even when we've run into problems with the Beit Din, there are ways to work around it. But at that point, you have a little bit of the upper hand, as opposed to when everything, and I always tell men and women that I see, do not sign any agreement. Do not finalize anything in the civil matters until you have your get. Because once you have signed and once you have an order out there, then all the tools available to you under the civil law are gone. But I think it's a wonderful piece of legislation. It hasn't been as successful as we hoped it had. I think not enough people are using it. I think the problems that we're running into with the Beit Din, I understand where they're coming from a halachic point of view, but I think there are certainly ways as a lawyer that I can work with that and around it.
I would just say, I don't know if I would go so far as to endorse Sharon's strategy of shooting first and asking questions later. But that said, these are extremely complex questions of halacha, meaning the answer is not clear one way or another. It depends on the particular statute that you're using. We deal with these questions under the New York get law, and it's really something that we address on a case-by-case basis depending on the facts and circumstances of the case. So it's hard to generalize in any real way other than to say they're complex questions.
Sharon, would in a case like that, if the Toronto Beth Din was refusing to administer the get, could you go to another Beit Din anywhere else in the United States?
The problem is both parties would have to cooperate to go to a Beit Din somewhere else, and you don't always have consent or cooperation to do it. You could. We don't have another Beit Din here.
Well, if a man really wanted to give the get.
He could. Yes, he could.
He could go to another Beit Din.
Yes. Theoretically, he absolutely could.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to thank you very much. Let's give a hand to our speakers. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up the mic here. I'm going to ask everyone to line up behind the mic. I'm going to ask you to keep your questions brief and also direct them to the person that you want. We're going to take one after the other, so we'll take a bunch and I'll write them out.
Hi, I just have a question about tactics, really. You've always taken the approach with people who are having trouble getting a get that we should try to solve it, you know, quietly first before resorting to demonstrations and that kind of thing. But it sometimes seems to backfire because when we do the quiet stuff, that's when the women tend to give up things that they shouldn't be giving up. And I'm just wondering if maybe is anybody done the opposite and started right in with demonstrations and things like that, especially when we're in a situation where the court's irrelevant, basically, to the question of whether we're doing it.
We're going to take all of them at once. Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah. I'm just wondering of another option. I know some people who had their marriages annulled. The basis of it was that had they known X, Y, or Z about this person, they would never have married them. So can't we use that to say, had I known he was going to be so evil and not give me a get, I would never have married him. So, and annul the marriage.
Thank you. Next.
I'll try and keep it simple. Under what conditions can a get be rescinded?
Okay, thank you.
So I'm wondering about if we have the attitude that withholding a get is abuse, then why do we care if we have rabbis endorsing a man, like, you know, endorsing protests and whatnot? Because if we would see a man abusing his wife, we wouldn't, you know, run and ask the rabbi what to do. We would call the cops. Like, so why this sort of disconnect that we need a rabbi stamp when it comes to withholding a get if we know the facts?
Question. Somebody signed a prenup and still refuses to give the get. What are the ramifications? Is it breach of contract or can he be imprisoned? Because basically he's just breaking a contract, I would think.
Anything further? Okay, so there's five questions on the table here. Let's start with the first one. There's one more. Into the mic, please. Thank you. Okay, one last one.
Just a quick comment. I think with the Beit Din in Toronto, the way they work, there are two, but the Beit Din for Gittin only operates when both people agree. So they'll only, if not, he will shift everything to the other Beis Din, which operates as.
That's okay. Could be right. It hasn't been my experience, but I can only talk about my experiences.
Okay. The question. An interesting comment was made that in from Israel, there's like a triple approach where they have three different agreements. Is from a legal point of view in Ontario, would that be something that could be done to work around this Sharia law?
Sharia law.
And if withholding a get is a form of abuse, if it's a form of abuse, wouldn't that also be able to be legally to work in a legal manner that way?
Okay, thank you.
To sort of.
All right, let's begin with the first question. Anybody can take it. Questioner is basically asking, the general approach is to go quiet and then go public, and that seems to backfire. Would it be more advisable to start with demonstrations, et cetera?
So I'll talk about the work that we do at ORA and our approach. We've found it to be an effective approach, generally speaking, and you know, this is from what we've seen, to apply pressure incrementally, and doing that combined with supporting the aguna who is suffering without a get emotionally and providing emotional support for her through this process. So it's two elements, both applying pressure incrementally and also supporting her through the process to make sure that she doesn't give up hope and give up anything in exchange for the get. Just as a general tactic, sometimes pushing someone too hard, too fast can really just push them away. Whereas if they feel that for every week that goes by they refuse to give the get, it's only going to get worse, then that continues to be a threatening element. Whereas once you've fired all the arrows in your quiver, you've nothing more that you can do to ramp up the pressure. That's been our experience when applying pressure.
I'd like to add a little bit to that. I think that a basic problem in today's society is that there is no shame anymore. And if you blast all your guns out, and he's already felt the exposure of the terrible things that he's done, then he really won't feel any shame afterwards. We can look at Aaron Friedman, for example. Even though that was done incrementally, he obviously it hasn't worked until now. So for the general get refuser, you can test the amount of shame that the person has by doing it incrementally. If you're sensitive enough and if you have the experience, then you'll know what's going to be effective. But if you right away start with rallies or Facebook or what have you, then you've lost the opportunity to measure that.
The second question, interestingly, talking about alternative methodologies for solving Hafkat Kiddushin, Ta'ut, if memory serves, certain modern rabbis put forward such suggestions. There, one recalls Eliezer Berkovitz and Emanuel Rachman and Shlomo Riskin, and they faced some pretty substantive pushback from the rabbinic community. But in any case, perhaps somebody here can address the issue of alternate resolutions.
Yes, it's correct. There have been efforts previously to go down this path. The efforts have not just been the likes of Emanuel Rachman, Rabbi Riskin, and others. There have been longstanding efforts by serious poskim to propose solutions that go down this path. But the difference between those two, meaning the historical serious poskim who proposed those things and other more modern efforts, is that the poskim, following the long tradition of how to handle these very difficult Jewish law cases, have always proposed their proposals in a tentative manner, have said that this is somewhat radical. I'm not proposing this lamaisa, I'm not proposing this as an actual thing to be implemented, because they realize that the seriousness or the downside of allowing women to remarry under questionable heterim, questionable permissions to remarry, are dire. It's the, potentially it can cause the mamzer to be born. That's not something anyone in this game wants to be a part of. And so that's why it's so important that any radical proposal or any proposal that goes beyond what has been the traditional method of handling these difficult cases, it needs universal acceptance. It doesn't mean that every last posek in the world needs to sign on, but it means it needs to enjoy the approval of a good chunk of the Gedol Yisrael, of the people who are accepted across the spectrum of orthodoxy. You can't do it based on one rabbi say-so. It's just not going to work. It's not going to work practically because you're not going to get a groundswell of rabbis who are going to perform marriages on the basis of those heterim. And it's not going to work because it's going to backfire. It's going to cause much more serious status issues a generation later than anyone can imagine.
Rabbi Kalman started off by saying that there was a recent article released, yeah. And I'm just wondering, is the Beit Din that they're talking about bringing in to North America, I don't know if you're aware of it, and it was announced.
Yeah, I read the Jewish Week. I read the Jewish Week article. I saw the YouTube announcement.
Is that what they're going to be doing, or?
That's what it sounds like. It's hard to know. Okay. You can't trust what you read in the newspapers. It's hard to know what they're planning on doing. Okay. They say that they have support from Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg is a serious posek. He is the co-author, essentially, of our prenup. He's someone that we turn to, that the Beth in America turns to on our most difficult questions of Jewish status. So he's a serious player. I find it hard to believe that he's going to be leading the charge with radical, out-of-the-box solutions that don't enjoy widespread support. So, you know, I don't know.
I'd like to add something, because I want to go to the depth of the question. In other words, the question was related to mekach ta'ut, a mistaken transaction, when you said that if I would have known, then I wouldn't have married him. The few and far between cases that there have been rulings of annulling the marriage due to a mekach ta'ut, it has been in cases where there was intentional, how do you say rama'ut?
Deception.
Thank you. Intentional deception that was proven by that the husband intentionally deceived the woman, and for a situation that existed already, and even then they would find many causes to add to it that they would annul the marriage, but the heart would be that there was a condition that existed before the marriage. And it's true, she wouldn't have married him if she would have known about the condition, and she may have even asked about it or inquired to try to check it out, and he lied about it. And then afterwards, after they were married, and then the problem came up and it blew up, and you were able to prove that this existed beforehand, and he deceived her, then there's a better, much better chance of being able to annul the marriage of a mekach ta'ut. However, modern health sciences have taught us, and this hasn't yet filtered into the halacha, the wheels of any legal system grind very slowly. So, but modern health sciences has taught us that if a man is abusive in his marriage, that the seeds of that abuse possibly existed even before the marriage, even if he didn't act out on it, or homosexuality, or something like that, even if he didn't act out on it, he only acted out on it afterwards, and even if he himself wasn't aware of it, and he didn't intentionally deceive the woman. So that's where I think your question is coming from. And halacha hasn't yet, or the great poskim have not yet grappled with that type of condition, that apparently this isn't something new that was just born, that he all of a sudden started to beat his wife, or that he decided that he was a homosexual, but that the seeds of those two conditions existed before the marriage, and even though there wasn't intentional deception, that we should accept that she would not have married him under those conditions. We're not there yet.
Rarely do I disagree with Dr. Levmore, but I'm only going to do it because I can refer to an article cited by a rabbi whom we both respect tremendously, especially in this area, Rabbi Michael Broyd, where in his review of Aviata Cohen's book, Tears of the Oppressed, he talks about this issue specifically, about what does the abuse literature teach us, the scientific literature that's been done, about can you demonstrate that there are latent psychological issues in an individual who 5 years, 10 years, 20 years into the marriage becomes a wife beater. At least what he has there, and maybe there are other things. What he has there is that the science does not demonstrate that we can say that there's a good likelihood, at least 50%, if not more, that someone who has particular character traits, a particular background, will indeed turn into a wife abuser. And the issue with Kiddushei Ta'ut is, we, in order for Kiddushei Ta'ut, for deception in a marriage, for that to be used as a halachic tool, the deception, the Ta'ut, must be something that's latent in the husband at the time of the Kiddushin transaction. It has to be that he didn't disclose to her a certain defect in his personality, psychology, behavior, whatever, at the time of the marriage. And if we can demonstrate that he definitely possessed particular traits which lead in the vast majority of cases to a particular behavior, if we can demonstrate that, then that would not be grounds for Kiddushei Ta'ut.
Now, I will add, really disagreeing.
Okay, good.
I will add to that that even in cases where there was intentional deception, at least it's what I've seen in the cases that came before in the past, the Israeli rabbinical courts, if it was a case of pure get refusal, I'm not referring to cases of mamzerut or chalitza, but just a married woman and setting her free, that they didn't even use, even in a case of deception, of out and out deception, they did not use that tool of mekach ta'ut. But I will say that at the present time, and this gives me a little bit of hope, it does give me hope, because I feel that what happens in Israel does emanate out and spread out in the entire Jewish world, that for the past few months, I've been undergoing a very interesting process. I myself have been interviewing candidates for Dayanut, to become Dayanim, as well as Dayanim that are sitting Dayanim who want to become Dayanim in the High Rabbinical Court. And I have been quizzing them specifically on this point. The majority of them, not all of them, have said that in a clear case of deception, that they would rule for an annulment and declare a mekach ta'ut. So there is change happening.
Moving to the next question, or the next few. The prenup is signed, no get given. What are the ramifications? Isn't it a broken contract?
Yes, so it's a good question. Let me walk you through the mechanism and how it actually plays out in real life. Where a prenup was signed, typically what will happen is the woman will call our office, say she's interested in arranging a get. We'll ask her to fax in, if it's not already in our registry, we'll ask her to fax in a copy of the prenup, and then we'll start by sending a hazmana. Usually I'll call the husband first, just because if he's interested in giving the get right away, there's no reason to make it adversarial at all. That might, you know, throw him off. And so I'll call him with a friendly phone call. But where he's not interested in arranging the get right away, we'll send out a hazmana with a copy of the prenup attached that says, your wife has contacted the Beth Din of America about arranging a get consistent with the terms of the attached prenup that you signed. Please contact their office to make arrangements or otherwise respond to this hazmana. What will then happen is he'll either call the office and schedule an appointment, which happens frequently when there's a prenup attached, because that will often resolve the case right then and there. But where it doesn't, and where he says, I'm not coming, or I want to go to a different Beis Din, or he just simply ignores us, we don't take no for an answer, because we have a prenup, we have jurisdiction. He doesn't have the right to choose another Beis Din, he doesn't have the right to ignore us. And so we'll send a second hazmana about 2 weeks later. Each hazmana has a deadline for responses. So we'll send the second hazmana, then we'll send the third hazmana about 12 days later. Then we'll send a letter asking him to submit dates on which he's available for a hearing pursuant to the terms of the prenup. If he ignores us still, we will, under our rules and procedures, we can schedule a hearing on our own. And so we'll usually check with her to find out what dates work for her. We'll then send out a notice on 8 days notice, 8 days prior notice to the husband or to both sides, setting the date and time for a hearing. We will then have a hearing. If he doesn't show up, this is very rare. Usually they'll at least show up, or by now he's given the get. But if he really is pushing it, we'll have a hearing in his absence. She will present her case to the Beis Din. It doesn't usually take very long because it's not a complicated case. The prenup says that once they're separated, he owes her $150 a day until he gives a get, until the divorce. And so she'll tell us the circumstances. The Dayanim will probably ask a few questions. And ultimately the Dayanim, if by now there's no get, will issue a written decision that constitutes an enforceable arbitration award, awarding her what would typically be, and again, this is rare because by now we usually have the get, but in theory, we would now issue an award to her of $150 per day, counting back, indexed to inflation, and for continuing support of $150 per day. She would then, by now we all the time have the get, but again, theoretically, if she still doesn't have the get now, she would take that to court and get an actual, she would confirm the award under the arbitration statutes. The court would issue a judgment, and then her lawyer would take that judgment and seek to enforce the judgment by garnishing wages or attaching his bank accounts or sending a strong man to take his car away or something like that. And by then, we always have the get.
Thank you. Are there conditions under which a get can be rescinded or taken back that anyone knows of?
So I want to actually put this in context. The first thing I want to do is introduce the three ladies sitting up front here who are social workers at Jewish Family and Child Services who deal with some of the most vulnerable, they're all blushing now, vulnerable members of our society. These are wonderful people who also run an abuse program. And these wonderful ladies are working with a woman in our community who was abused by her spouse, received a get, and shortly after she received her get, some circumstances occurred. She got nervous and she called the police because she was concerned. The police laid some charges against her husband, and ultimately it was resolved by the husband entering into a peace bond. He does not have a criminal record, but he has a peace bond, which means he has to stay away from her and from her place of work. This young woman then received a letter from the Beit Din of Toronto that basically said the document, the Tudat Patur issued to you from the Beit Din, is hereby declared null and void. So they rescinded her get, and at the moment she is, in my book, still considered an aguna because her husband, because halachically he's still considered her husband, is perpetuating the abuse and is not granting her a get.
Stop for a second. Yes. I'm a bit confused. Yes. She got the get originally?
She got the get originally back in, I think it was December.
Maybe all of you can speak to this. A get once given can be taken back by a Beit Din?
So I'm going to stop and simply say I wanted to set out the circumstances under which this question was asked because I think whoever's going to answer this question needs to put it into context. So that's it was rescinded by this, if a letter can do it. I don't know the halakha in this at all, but this was the letter that she had
nor
received.
I, so. Anybody want to take that one? Because really,
thank you, Sharon.
What a friend for
me. The truth is, I don't really feel comfortable commenting on an active case in front of another Beit Din. The Beit Din of America has an active and strong relationship, a positive relationship with the Beit Din of Toronto. That we work together with them in resolving cases. I don't think it would be appropriate for me to comment on a case.
I'm less interested in the Toronto aspect. I'm asking a more general question. Have you ever had a case, or have you heard of cases where that is done, has been done, can be done?
Rachel Levmore can comment more because this is something that the content. No, I'll tell you why. I'm not trying to pass the buck. I am trying to pass the buck. But it's something that's enjoyed some amount of attention in Israel recently. There's some halachic literature. I could tell you that the Beis Din of America I'm not aware of any case in which this has happened at the Beth Din of America. It's very rare. I would imagine anyone would tell you this is rare.
Okay.
Although Rachel Levmer can talk about maybe developments in Israel along these lines, because there's been some. The Beth Din in Israel have grappled with this issue from time to time.
It's rare and it's outrageous. It's simply outrageous. Usually, when a get is given, the dayanim are supposed to go through a whole procedure, just like when you get married, there's a certain ceremony. So when you get divorced, there's a certain marriage ceremony. When you get married, you have a ketubah, it's written. When you get divorced, you have the get, which is written. And in part of the ceremony, the man repeatedly has to say that he's giving the get lelo kol tnai. In other words, he without any condition, and he has not made any pronouncements, and he has not sworn to do this, that, or the other thing, that it is not contingent upon anything. And that is the way you're supposed to, if you're a Beit Din, that is the way you're supposed to arrange for the get. So in Israel, that's done all the time. I don't know about outside of Israel. Nevertheless, in Israel, there were about two, maybe three cases. Since the issue, there's a very big issue, an explosive issue in Israel, which is called the battle for jurisdiction between the civil court and the rabbinical court, not in terms of the get. In terms of the get, the rabbinical court has sole jurisdiction by law, by civil law. But there's parallel jurisdiction between the two different types of court systems in everything related to a divorce, meaning the money and the kids. Right? So there were a few Haredi couples. Many times a get is given on the basis of a divorce agreement, and in the divorce agreement they agree that any future disputes they have will be handled by the Beit Din Rabbani, by the rabbinical court. And in a couple of cases with Haredi couples, such a divorce agreement was signed. And then the man gave the get, and they went through the regular ceremony of giving a get without any conditions. But then nevertheless, there was a dispute arose afterwards, child support or something like that, and the Haredi wife would go to the Beit Din, but the Beit Din did not help her, so she has the legal right. She has the legal right, despite what she signed in the divorce agreement, to go to the civil court to ask for relief in terms of the child support. And when she did it, the husbands got so angry, and they would go to the Beit Din and they would say, I gave the get on the basis, assuming that she could never go to the civil court. And this happened maybe in maybe like 6 years ago or so, in a couple of cases with one or two particular dayanim, that they did indeed nullify the get, which left the woman hanging. It's outrageous, because the whole purpose of this ceremony is to make sure that she doesn't it's clear cut. There's even a cherem against people. There's a cherem against lohotzi la'azal get. There's a cherem. There's like a threat of excommunication on anybody that you may not say bad things about a certain get that is not valid. But thank God, there haven't been any more instances of that happening, and the two dayanim that were involved retired.
Okay. So lastly, one for you, because you were the one who introduced the language, the sort of equivalency, you know, not withholding equals domestic abuse. So we had a question, I think that's following up on your language, that if it's domestic abuse, if you saw somebody abusing somebody, you go to the cops, why do you need anybody to endorse this, rabbis, community, etc.? I think they were just following the line of your thinking.
Yes, there's no question it's domestic abuse. The question that we're always asking ourselves, and this is along the lines of what I said about tactics, is what's going to be most effective? We're not interested in standing on ceremony or just stating our principles, and we want to consider what's going to be most effective. And the most effective approach we generally find is to try to work with the rabbis, the batei din, the community, the family, friends, associates, whoever it is, to try and garner as much support as possible when it comes to the point of applying pressure, and to try to use all of those people and all of those resources to rescind their support of the recalcitrant husband. So it's not that you know, you need a necessarily, in order to call it abuse, you need a rabbi to say that. The question is just when it comes to an issue of applying pressure, what's going to be most effective. And I'll also add that there are serious halakhic issues at play. You know, if it comes to whether or not there are grounds to kick your husband out of shul, or to go after his business and to try and cause him to lose his parnasa, you know, and if that impacts the get or not, so there are halachic issues that are at play, and so that's why you need a good posik to address those issues, or a beit din to weigh in on those issues. But that is a takeaway from the fact that his behavior is unacceptable and it's abusive. But again, in terms of tactics and also making sure that what we're doing is not going to have any negative halachic implications.
I would add to that experience has shown that in each one of these cases, each case is a world of its own. It's extremely complex, and people are complex. So if you're well-meaning, and it's not, and you take some action, but it's not done in a coordinated manner. Coordination here is crucial. It's like you need a person on top to coordinate all the different actions that you're taking. It's because someone who's well-meaning is going to say, oh, you know what? I'm a family lawyer. I'm well-versed in family law, and I understand where everybody's coming from. I'm going to go in and volunteer to negotiate between everybody. That may be destructive, because the people in charge of this mission may have decided that, you know, we need a blackout now. Nobody has to talk to him. So whatever you do, it has to be coordinated.
Okay, so we'll do that privately. So it's important to realize that this issue, get with refusal, it's not a women's issue, it's not a feminist issue, it's a human rights issue, plain and simple, and I hope that everybody here has come away illuminated, educated, and will support Agunot and support the process towards allowing them to be freed and unchained. So we're just going to ask for no. Okay. So thank you very much. Okay. Yeah. Thanks very much for coming.